Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, the podcast dedicated to M.A.R. Barker's legendary world of Tecumel.
Are you ready, guys?
Sure.
All right. Victor, I understand you have some more news about Empire of the Petal Throne.
Yes. I am even now finishing up the errata and some of the rules clarifications that appeared after Empire of the Petal Throne was produced. And we're going to include those in some additional notes at the very end of the TSR EPT. This will make, I think, a complete set then. You know, people will still have to acquire the maps from the original game, which we have as PDF downloads. But past that, they will have the complete rulebook. So, the errata, they're just fascinating stuff, just utterly fascinating things. Not the least of which is discovering that cure disease and cure light or serious wounds and neutralize poison. None of those apparently work against radiation damage.
Ah, well,
kind of makes sense. Yeah.
Sure.
Yes, and
that's mentioned in the dragon.
Oh yes.
I have to go back and take a look at that. That seems an odd thing to have come up.
Recently, reported Professor Barker, I had a party pass through a radioactive hot ruined city just south of Bayarsha in the jungles. They tried both neutralized poison and the cure disease spells, but I finally decided that neither of these would work on radiation damage, since this was not caused by a substance entering the bloodstream or stomach, nor was it caused by bacteria. They are still suffering from the effects of this experience and accepted the decision with ill grace. But my player's grace, he says parenthetically, is almost always ill, anyhow.
Excellent, especially when they're suffering from radiation damage.
Such sympathy on the part of the GM.
It's a fine attitude.
A fine attitude. There you are. With that'll be it. We've got the cover art done, or I should say resolution on the cover art done, and then we have the other materials underway, and so I think we're going to be going for those proof copies quite soon.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's super exciting. I might have to splurge for a hard
me
cover.
Me too. So that way my original copy won't suffer the slings and arrows of being battered about so much.
I printed out and bound the current PDF, but I would like, for sake of the awesome factor, to have the new current version in hardback.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to all that, I'm going to be running an Legions of the Petal Throne game at GaryCon this year.
Ooh.
Yep. And we'll be using Professor Barker's miniatures.
Well, I was just going to ask, what sort of miatures are you going to be using for that?
Yes.
Bummed I'm not going to that con.
It will probably be the last time that we actually use Professor Barker's miniatures, as I am hoping to take advantage of Howard Fielding's marvelous miniatures and build up an army of my very own. We'll see. So,
well, please take a lot of good quality photographs.
Yes, please.
Will do. And Paul Stormberg, who is coordinating the events of the miniatures events where this is taking place, he's not doing all of them, just the ones in the Legends of Wargaming room. He reported to me that the event is full, that it is sold out. So
what a surprise.
I better have enough things for players to do.
Will you have any terrain for the miniatures event?
Oh, yes. That's being provided. And so I'm even now in the process of coming up with a scenario that should be Interesting.
I was just going to ask what the scenario was.
Not determined quite yet, but we'll take care of it.
You have a few weeks to figure it out.
Yes. So let's see here. So there's all of that. Yeah, that's the latest and greatest, I would say.
That's pretty great, actually.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. I heard something about a documentary about constructed languages.
Thank you for reminding me. Yes. I just got together the other day with Britton Watkins, who is putting together a documentary on constructed languages. And it's utterly fascinating. And I'm not just saying that because Professor Barker and Tecumel and Soliani are mentioned and featured in it. They're looking at a whole range of constructed languages. But Soliani gets some serious attention. And they interviewed me as part of this. And so I'm looking forward to seeing what they do. But I have to tell you, I was enthralled by everyone else, and I found myself worrying whether or not I was actually going to make a real contribution. But Britton basically assured me that everything was okay. So there you go.
Good.
And I'm going to let me see here. Give me a moment. It can be found at conlangingfilm.com.
Oh. So what is it? Is it available?
There is an introduction and there's a profile of the different people working on it.
Ah.
It's quite impressive.
I shall have to look at it later then.
Yes. conlangingfilm.com. So.
What other languages are covered in this documentary?
Let's see here. Navi from Avatar is one. Another one, as I mentioned, is Dovraki and some of the languages from A Game of Thrones. There's also some discussion about, Klingon, and some discussion with Mark Okrand. And then also, I mean, those are sort of the media tie-in languages, but then just a range of different languages that people have created both in the past and in the present. And so it's looking at a whole range of ways in which people approach language. Mm. So in that sense, I think it'll be a lot of fun. I was seeing a... one of the most recent edits to it, and it's just fascinating.
Did you learn much about the why of the making of this documentary and also the provenance of who was behind it?
Britton Watkins is well, in his own language, I mean, his own way of putting about it, he has been aware of the existence of languages like Esperanto and Klingon, but when he started looking at this in more detail, he realized that people had been constructing languages for centuries, and the documentary itself is being made by people who are involved in this, and so it's being made both for people specifically interested in this, but also for a greater audience, a bigger audience. So Britton himself has a number of people helping produce it, but really, I mean, I could go into more detail, but the important aspect of this is On the Horizon should be coming out soon.
That's great.
Cool. Sounds interesting.
I have a topic that I would like to ask James about.
Oh, yes?
Yes. And it might be something that we will unpack in greater detail at a later time. But now that the Sokatis campaign is going far away.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
So in a way, we're kind of going off the map. And
yes.
I would just like to hear your thoughts as a GM and content creator, really, about what you do when people go off the map.
Oh, gee. It's interesting because I think I've mentioned I have two EPT campaigns. There's Sokatis, one that you participate in, and then there's my nominally Mughal-Avani campaign that I also run. And in both cases now, the players have either already gone off the map or are about to do so. It's something I sort of thought a lot about. Actually, I shouldn't say that. Thought implies that I've taken a lot very careful time to do this. But rather, what I've done, I think, is realize that, first of all, I don't worry about it quite as much as I might have done once upon a time. The kinds of things that if you're playing in Empire of Palthrand or techno games in general, I think, after a while, the logic of the setting starts to sort of seep into you, I guess, a bit. So it's not like I sit down and I think, oh, so what is this place going to be like so much? I have an idea in a vague sense of what things are going to look like. This isn't a very good answer, actually.
No, it's a great answer. I think it's getting to the heart of your creative process with regard to this leg of the campaign.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I know I've told the story of Professor Barker and, closing your eyes and thinking and being transported to Techamel. And I thought at the time that was crazy. But now that I've done it for a while, I see some truth to it. It's just, I can't speak for anyone else. I begin to feel like I know what Techamel is like and what it should look like. And even places that aren't Sol-Yani, I sort of have a notion of, this would work, but this wouldn't, kind of a thing. So I sort of feel my way around. The one thing I do that I do come up with beforehand is I play around with words, names for things and names for people and places, so that I'll come up with a list of words, a couple dozen of them, and sort of play around with them just so that I have things that sound right to me. And I wish I could tell you exactly the process by which I do this. Mostly I just sort of, it's just trial and error. I sort of look at, does that look like something that's a word that could be spoken by someone on Techamel? Does it sound right? How would you pronounce this? And then if I like it, I put it aside and I add it to my little list. So I have it on my table, my desk when I'm running something. And then if I need to describe something or you encounter someone, it's like, okay, it's called this. And then I make a note of it. And then you sort of build up slowly, I guess. I'm not really in anymore to grand building before the fact. That seems to put the cart before the horse. It takes a lot of work. And also I think it holds, it has the problem that potentially you're going to establish too many things early and tie your hands creatively. Something might come up over the course of a session and then say, it would be really great to include this thing. Or wouldn't it be better if, I do as much as I absolutely need to, which is not very much. The main thing, it's just I've done it for a while now, so I feel a certain kind of comfortability with the setting, so I'm not so off-put by, it doesn't seem so daunting to me as it once would have, I guess. I don't know. Is that a good answer?
It's a great answer. I think it's funny that you should say doing not very much work means producing six issues of The Excellent Traveling Mind.
Well, but okay, fair enough. But I mean, a lot of that just sort of comes out of actually playing or thinking about playing, rather than I didn't do almost any of that beforehand. A lot of it is inspired by things that actually have happened in the course of one or the other of the games. So it doesn't feel to me like it's a lot of work, but maybe it is. Maybe I'm downplaying the significance of it, but.
Everyone has different things that they're naturally suited to doing.
Mm.
So this kind of work for you is not an undue amount of effort.
No, not generally. Not generally. It's sometimes it can be so. But what is really great, though, too, And I think probably, I mean, Victor, you could probably even speak to this a little bit as well, with regards to what you saw in Professor Parker's campaigns. But one of the things that makes it a little bit easier sometimes, quite frankly, is the interaction with the players. Because I will be the first, I will happily admit the fact that my players sometimes have better ideas than I do. So when I present something in a kind of open-ended kind of a way, and it's sort of, it's there and it's a bit vague, they'll start asking questions, or they may begin to see a pattern or piece things together in a way that I might otherwise not have done. It's like, actually, that's really a good idea. And then I run with it. So I think actually playing makes it a lot easier than just sort of thinking of it in an abstract kind of a way.
That brings part of the power of a recurring weekly game to bear as well.
Most definitely. Most definitely. You want to say, Victor?
Well, I have to say that Professor Barker operated in a very similar way, that in many cases he would not necessarily know immediately what things were like until we actually went somewhere or we interacted with the setting in some way. And so our adventures were the way in which he explored the world of Tecumel and shared it with us. And so much of what you just said matches my own experience sitting at his gaming table.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, no,
that's good. And you're right too. I mean, Scott, what you were saying about a regular playing, I think helps a great deal in terms of this, because everyone after a while, and not just the referee, but I mean, the players develop a facility with the setting, a comfortability with it that makes it a lot easier to go outside the lines, so to speak, and fill in details. And I very rarely will ever turn away a suggestion by a player where they say, oh, well, it, you know, I would like it to be like this, or I do this thing that we'd never established before. So, oh, cool, sure, great. That helps to add some depth and even and breadth to the setting. And I find my players just as inspirational as the actual source material itself, sometimes, frankly, even more so.
Seems like momentum plays a big part in developing verisimilitude. It's hard just to pick up something every now and again.
Yes, I agree. That's true. Also, because I think when you're playing regularly, there's a certain kind of necessity to constantly develop new material and go outside of what's been established. You know, and again, we've talked about this before. I know Victor and I have talked about it some length. A lot of times, people who complain, well, not complain, are intimidated, say, by the Tecumel source book and talk about there's so much there. And there is. And I don't want to downplay that. It makes me realize they've never actually played for any length of time, because many of the subjects that are addressed there, yes, there is plenty of information and lots more than there might be on many fantasy settings. But if you're playing at any, you know, with regularly and for any length of time, you will exhaust some of what is there on any given topic after a while, and you will have to start expanding upon it. It's just absolutely necessary to do that.
What kind of like deep research into canonical materials do you do when you're off the map, as they say? For example, the Blue Room archive off techml.com has a lot of stuff that never really found its way into sources.
I do occasionally take a look at that and sort of type in a few words and see if there is anything. And then I look through the source book, and the PDF of the source book is quite useful to have to sort of just look for words to see if anything comes up. And there's also the very nice index that now exists, which is a lovely thing. But beyond that, that's about it. They're the things I search for just to check to see if ever the topic that I don't think I have information about, there is something that someone's talked about previously. And lots of topics have been, you know, if only very loosely or lightly touched. If there isn't, then that's fine. Then you just sort of extrapolate from what's there, because there is so much already available. You can sort of get a sense of what things would kind of be like. I mean, I think that must be true. Most people who play Tekken after a while is like, nah, that's not right. Or, okay, that's good. And then even when things are weird or different than what's typical for, say, Tsolyanu or even any of the Engsvanyali descended cultures, you can sort of get a sense of it's weird in the right way. It feels like that's a strange thing that would be on Tekamel as opposed to a strange thing that it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true. I
totally
hope that
makes
true.
Sense.
Oh, I would agree. I think there are some things that people have proposed in the past that might not necessarily fit in with many other versions of Tekamel. I recall quite distinctly that a Tekamel fan who was a very ardent fan of Tekamel a number of years ago had decided that somewhere down the line there ought to be Mechasro. And, you know, Professor Barker made it very clear that, you know, if that's what was going on in his Tekamel, that was perfectly fine. Mostly in the sense of saying, hey, people are having fun with the game. People are having fun with the world. Wonderful.
Exactly. Okay.
But at the same time, he was also very clear in saying that he didn't foresee that. Now, you know, being on what he would, you know, on Professor Barker's Tekamel. That having been said, I would be hard-pressed to say that something couldn't be on Tekamel. There's always the possibility for something truly strange or different or
mm-hmm.
or seemingly anachronistic, or there should be some word for, you know, it's not out of time, but it's out of space, right? It's not in the right place. But really, it's limited only by your imagination.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, true.
You could make a case for a Mechasro, I think.
Certainly, some lord of the latter times had decided that there was a need for something of that sort.
Sure.
Mind you, the question would then be, and where is it now and why? But you know, stranger things have been known to happen. You know, Tekamel has got all sorts of mysteries that exist and have existed and will continue to exist, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. I mean, I think we've talked about this before, too. I mean, one of the great advantages of Tekamel as a setting is that it is a very old world, and there's a lot that's unknown. Much of its history is lost to the mists of time, at least from the perspective of the people who are currently alive on Tekamel. So you can fit in all sorts of things. I mean, I know it wouldn't be hard to imagine, you know, entire cultures, civilizations even, that have existed on Tekamel and then disappeared. That people don't know about because of where they were located and just the sort of, you know, rather patchy nature of historical record at times. Like, so that does free you from doing a lot of different things. And I think what Scott said too about there being a Mechasro, like, is a good point. There are plenty of, I think almost anything is possible on a localized or small sort of basis, but once you start getting into bigger sorts of things, that's where I sort of have a sense that some things work and some things don't. At least for me,
no army of Mechastro.
No, I would find that hard to accept. In a similar fashion, I would find a hard time imagining, for example, a civilization that was too strong, a society, a culture, or whatever, that was too strongly influenced by sort of like, you know, European medievalism, for example, something like that. That would feel out of place to me. I could and have borrowed elements from those cultures, but a full-on sort of thing where you have knights and castles and things of that sort, that would feel not right to me.
I would say that from Professor Barker's perspective, that the lands of the Tanne and the Sro Riders are probably as close
mm-hmm.
as he would get to that. You know, that sort of medieval feudalism. Professor Barker was far more influenced by ancient cultures than he was by the Middle Ages.
Yeah, that's my sense of it too. And when I do look for inspiration, the ancient world and sort of, and I mean this in the most broad sense, sort of, you know, Asian cultures tend to be more influential on my sort of the things that I look and say, oh, that's an interesting aspect of this particular culture. I may borrow that or something. But I tend to stay away from, you know, later European things. I mean, it's just a personal sort of feeling. It feels, Tecmel feels, I say, more like an ancient world to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only is it out of context in game or in world within the fictive environment, just from a metagaming perspective, I think it just breaks the genre.
Yes, I'm inclined to agree with that too. So, but there it is.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other aspect of this as well is that Professor Barker actively encouraged us to imagine on our own things that might be somewhere on Tecmel as a way for us to assist him in the world creation process. It wasn't to say that he would accept anything willy-nilly, but there was opportunity for people to, as things moved along, you know, as the campaign developed, people found ways that they could contribute based mm-hmm. on the interests that they had.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but can you think of any examples of that that were particularly noteworthy that you can recall, or?
Well, certainly, for example, the gnome as a culture and people was very much a part of the Tuesday night group adventuring, and the original write-up for the gnome was done by Neil Cawley.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Can you give us the elevator pitch for the gnome? It's not ringing a bell with me.
The gnome are a very dark-skinned people who are far to the east and past the Isle of Ilwynd and the Anmutlehlektis and the Ahogya Nation that exists far, far to the east. And the gnome have a very different approach to magic, and their culture would be very alien to that of the five empires. I'd have to go back and look at the original material. There's a write up of them in the Tecmel Bestiary, and then also an article that appeared in the Imperial Courier. And I think that means we're going to have to work on getting that out and available to people again, since it's source material that people would appreciate.
I wouldn't complain.
Yeah, me neither. I have a couple of those Imperial Couriers, but I know that there's plenty more of them out there.
And they are hard to acquire.
Yeah, the difficulty, I mean, I have, I think, most, if not all, the complete set of them, is that because they were produced, the Imperial Couriers were produced by Tecmel Games, not all of the material in there is readily, we're not in a position where we can always reprint everything. And so unlike some earlier material, which we can just reproduce in a very straightforward way, it'll take a little bit of work to tease out what's available for reprint and what we still need to work on getting available by talking with the authors.
So yeah, well, it's the right thing to do, to give credit where credit is due, of course, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
But so, tracking down some of these people might prove to be a challenge.
Fortunately, I know a fair number of them, and so that is not completely impossible, but I suspect that they're there's been a lot of time that's gone by, so we'll see if people are available for this and what we can do about using their material. Mm-hmm. So
that's great.
Yes.
I'm not trying to plug my band, but it's a relevant anecdote. We did a cover of a song that was kind of a minor hit in the 1960s, and the album's coming out in March. And so we had to track down the copyright holder of the song.
Mm.
And that wasn't particularly easy, and it turned out that the writing team that made the song, both of those guys are dead. So the only person we could find was the widow of one of the guys, who was in her 70s or maybe early 80s, but definitely pretty advanced in years. And it took a while even to hear back from her. So there was a minute there while we were wondering if we would be able to include the song on the record, but it turns out that we were, after all. So hooray.
Yeah.
I guess I did plug my band a little, right?
Nah.
That's
I mean, let's face it, there are other bands out there that have gaming connections.
Mm-hmm.
The Lord Slowfeg, the heavy metal band that's made up of at least some Traveler fans, is out there.
Well, I have an entire Traveler concept album, so.
Then there's the Darkest of the Hillside Thickets.
Yes.
A Cthulhu-themed band.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, well, Scott, maybe then one day you could do a song entirely in Sliani.
Well, that would be a challenge. You know what I have been doing kind of part-time as a composer is trying to channel or figure out how the music of Tekemel might sound.
Mm.
So in my career, I've done a lot of work with sound design and programming synthesizers to have unique kind of non-natural or kind of non-earth-like timbres and tonal characteristics. So maybe that will come back around.
That would be interesting.
Very fascinating. Absolutely.
Well, there's a little bit of information about the music of Tekemel in the source materials. It's more of a description of a couple of the instruments and just some kind of broad music theory terms. There's nothing really particular, but it's enough to go on, you know?
Although I think, again, Victor, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Did not Professor Barker have some notion of what Tekemel music sounded like?
Yes.
With reference to real world, you know, earth cultures.
Yeah.
Some sense of that.
Oh, sure. I mean, there are different inspirations there. I actually, if I recall correctly, and I should be careful about this, but I wondered to what extent that they sounded sort of, you know, some Tekemeliani music sounded like, Indian ragas. And Professor Barker actually said not so much, you know, which I found to be interesting that he was rather clear about that. But the instruments like the tenterein and the sorur, you know, the tenterein being the big, you know, very long-bodied stringed instrument that it seemed to be in some ways reminiscent of the Japanese. I'm forgetting the name of the instrument. It's played with a plectrum. Do you recall which one
I don't recall. I know I can hear it in my mind's ear, but
I know which one you were talking about, but I do not know the name of it. I'm afraid.
The tenterein, and then along with it, the sorur, the sort of lute like sorur. Two different instruments that were ones that I recall from discussions with Professor Barker. And then there were others, too, you know. He was actually fairly clear in describing what things looked like. And oftentimes, I think we were having a chance to see what music would sound like, again, if it were from a non-European perspective. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think I'm inspired to pick up the Schlainhide gauntlet here.
Please.
Yeah. Well, you know, in electronic music or composing for film and its related disciplines, there are pieces of software that you can program or configure to, in a kind of banal sense, replicate existing earth instruments, but in a more fascinating sense to me is you can create instruments that have never existed on Earth. And some of these software packages are able to let you model string instruments and provide them with different characteristics And that's all right up my street with regard to the kind of music work that I enjoy doing. So who knows?
Yeah, who knows indeed.
Thank you for listening to the Hall of Blue Illumination. You can email us your questions, queries, and other topics at citizen@techmlpodcast.com. You can also find TechML Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, take care and have fun playing in the world of TechML.